Horsfield, we're going to need mucho, LP. Tell me something I don't know, Twitch said. According to the inventory card on the door, there's supposed to be 7 of those puppies, but there are only 2. He stowed the cigarette in the pocket of his own white coat. I checked the other shed, just to make sure. Thought somebody might have moved the tanks. Why would anyone do that? I don't know, oh great one. Anyway, the other shed's for the really important hospital supplies, gardening and landscaping shit. In that one, the tools are present and accounted for, but the fucking fertilizer's gone. Rusty didn't care about the fertilizer, he cared about the propane. Well, if push comes to shove, we'll get some from the town supplies. You'll get a fight from Rennie. When Kathy Russell might be his only option if that ticker of his vapor locks, I doubt it. You think there's any chance I can get away for a while this afternoon? That'd be up to the whiz. He now appears to be the ranking officer. Where is he? Sleeping in the lounge. Snores like a mad bastard, too. You want to wake him up? No, Rusty said. Let him sleep. And I'm not going to call him the whiz anymore. Given how hard he's worked since this shit came down, I think he deserves better. Ah, so, Sensei, you have reached a new level of enlightenment. Blow me, Grasshopper, Rusty said. 10. Now see this. See it very well. It's 2:40 p.m. on another eye-bustingly gorgeous autumn day in Chester's Mill. If the press were not being kept away, they'd be in photo op heaven. And not just because the trees are in full flame. The imprisoned people of the town have migrated to Alden Dinsmore's dairy field en masse. Alden has struck a use fee deal with Romeo Burpee. $600. Both men are happy. The farmer because he jacked the businessman up considerable from Burpee's starting offer of 200. Romeo because he would have gone to 1,000 if pressed. From the protesters and Jesus shouters, Alden collected not a single crying dime. That doesn't mean he isn't charging them, however. Farmer Dinsmore was born at night, but not last night. When this opportunity came along, he marked out a large parking area just north of the place where the fragments of Chuck Thompson's plane came to rest the day before, and there he has stationed his wife, Shelley, his older son, Ollie, you remember Ollie, and his hired man, Manuel Ortega, a no-green card Yankee who can aya with the best of them. Alden's knocking down $5 a car, a fortune for a shirt-tailed dairyman who for the last 2 years has been keeping his farm out of Keyhole Bank's hands by the skin of his teeth. There are complaints about the fee, but not many. They charge more to park at the Freiburg Fair, and unless folks want to park by the side of the road, which has already been lined on both sides by early arrivals, and then walk half a mile to where all the excitement is, they have no choice. And what a strange and varied scene. A three-ring circus for sure, with the ordinary citizens of the mill and all the starring roles. When Barbie arrives with Rose and Ants Wheeler, the restaurant is closed again, we'll reopen for supper, just cold sandwiches, no grill orders. They stare in open-mouthed silence. Both Julia Shumway and Pete Freeman are taking pictures. Julia stops long enough to give Barbie her attractive but somehow inward-turning smile. Some show, wouldn't you say? Barbie grins. Yes'm. In the first ring of this circus, we have the townsfolk who have responded to the posters put up by Scarecrow Joe and his cadre. The protest turnout has been quite satisfying, almost 200, and the 60 signs the kids made, the most popular, "Let us out, damn it," were gone in no time. Luckily, many people did bring their own signs. Joe's favorite is the one with prison bars inked over a map of the mill. Lissa Jameson is not just holding it, but pumping it aggressively up and down. Jack Evans is there, looking pale and grim. His sign is a collage of photographs featuring the woman who bled to death the day before. "Who killed my wife?" it screams. Scarecrow Joe feels sorry for him. But what an awesome sign. If the press could see that one, they'd fill their collective pants with joy shit. Joe organized the protesters into a big circle that rotates just in front of the dome, which is marked by a line of dead birds on the Chester's Mill side. Those on the Motton side have been removed by the military personnel. The circle gives all of Joe's people, for so he thinks of them, a chance to wave their signs at the posted guards, who stand with their backs resolutely and maddeningly turned. And Joe also gave out printed chant sheets. He wrote these with Benny Drake's skateboarding idol, Nori Calvert. Besides being balls to the wall on her blitz deck, Nori's rhymes are simple but tight, yo. One chant goes, ha ha ha, he he he, Chester's mill must be set free. Another, you did it, you did it, come on out and just admit it. Joe has, with real reluctance, vetoed another Nori masterpiece that goes, take off the gags, take off the gags, let us talk to the press, you fags. We have to be politically correct about this, he told her. What he's wondering just now is if Nori Calvert is too young to kiss, and if she would slip him any tongue if he did. He has never kissed a girl, but if they're all going to die like starving bugs trapped under a Tupperware bowl, he probably should kiss this one while there's still time. In the second ring is Pastor Coggins' prayer circle. They are really getting God-sent. And, in a fine show of ecclesiastical detente, the Holy Redeemer Choir has been joined by a dozen men and women from the Congo Church Choir. They're singing, A Mighty Fortress is Our God. And a good number of unaffiliated townsfolk who know the words have joined in. Their voices rise to the blameless blue sky. With Lester's shrill exhortations and the prayer circle's supporting cries of Amen and Hallelujah, weaving in and out of the singing in perfect counterpoint. Although not harmony, that would be going too far. The prayer circle keeps growing as other townsfolk drop to their knees and join in, laying their signs temporarily aside so they can raise their clasped hands in supplication. The soldiers have turned their backs. Perhaps God has not. But the center ring of this circus is the biggest and most bodacious. Romeo Burpee pitched the end-of-summer blowout sail tent well back from the dome and 60 yards east of the prayer circle, calculating the location by testing the faint gasp of breeze that's blowing. He wants to make sure that the smoke from his rank of hibachis reaches both those praying and those protesting. His only concession to the afternoon's religious aspect is to make Toby Manning turn off his boombox, which was blaring that James McMurtry song about living in a small town. It didn't mix well with How Great Thou Art and Won't You Come to Jesus. Business is good and will only get better. Of this Romeo is sure. The hot dogs, thawing even as they cook, may gripe some bellies later, but they smell perfect in the warm afternoon sun, like a county fair instead of chow time in prison. Kids race around waving pinwheels and threatening to set Dinsmore's grass on fire with leftover 4th of July sparklers. Empty paper cups that held either citrus powder drinks, foul, or hastily brewed coffee, fouler still, are littered everywhere. Later on, Romeo will have Toby Manning pay some kid, maybe Dinsmore's $10, to pick up the litter. Community relations, always important. Right now, though, Romeo's totally focused on his jackleg cash register, a carton that once contained charm and toilet paper. He takes in long green and returns short silver. It's the way America does business, honey bunch. He's charging $4 per dog, and he's goddamn if people aren't paying it. He expects to clear at least $3,000 by sundown, maybe a lot more. And look, here's Rusty Everett. He got away after all. Good for him. He almost wishes he'd stopped to get the girls. They would surely enjoy this. And it might allay their fears to see so many people having a good time. But it might be a little too much excitement for Janny. He spots Linda at the same time she spots him and starts waving frantically, practically jumping up and down. With her hair done in the stubby, fearless police girl braids she almost always wears when she's working, Lynn looks like a junior high school cheerleader. She's standing with Twitch's sister Rose and the young man who short orders at the restaurant. Rusty's a little surprised. He thought Barbara had left town. Got on Big Jim Rennie's bad side. A bar fight is what Rusty heard, although he wasn't on duty when the participants came in to get patched up. Fine by Rusty. He's patched up his share of Dipper's customers. He hugs his wife, kisses her mouth, then plants a kiss on Rose's cheek, shakes hands with the cook, and gets reintroduced. Look at all these hot dogs, Rusty mourns. Oh, dear. Better line of the bedpan stock, Barbie says, and they all laugh. It's amazing to be laughing under these circumstances. But they aren't the only ones, and good God, why not? If you can't laugh when things go bad, laugh and put on a little carnival. Then you're either dead or wishing you were. This is fun, Rose says, unaware of how soon the fun is going to end. A frisbee floats past. She plucks it out of the air and wings it back to Benny Drake, who leaps to catch it, and then spins to throw it onto Nori Calvert, who catches it behind her back. Show off. The prayer circle prays. The mixed choir, really finding its voice now, has moved on to that all-time chart-topper, Onward Christian Soldiers. A child no more than Judy's age bops past, skirt flapping around her chubby knees, a sparkler clutched in one hand, and a cup of the awful limeade in the other. The protesters turn and turn in a widening gyre, chanting, "Ha, ha, ha, he, 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 Chester's mill must be set free." Overhead, puffy clouds with shady bottoms float northward from Motton, and then divide as they near the soldiers, skirting around the dome. The sky directly overhead is a cloudless, flawless blue. There are those in Dinsmore's field who study those clouds and wonder about the future of rain in Chester's Mill. But nobody speaks of this aloud. "I wonder if we'll still be having fun next Sunday," Barbie says. Linda Everett looks at him. It's not a friendly look.
"Surely you think before then..."
Rose interrupts her.
"Look over there. That kid shouldn't be driving that damn rig so fast. He'll tip it over. I hate those ATVs."
They all look at the little vehicle with the fat balloon tires and watch as it cuts a diagonal through the October white hay. Not toward them, exactly, but certainly toward the dome. It's going too fast. A couple of the soldiers hear the approaching engine and finally turn around.
"Oh, Christ, don't let him crash," Linda Everett moaned.
Rory Dinsmore doesn't crash. It would have been better if he had. 11. An idea is like a cold germ. Sooner or later, someone always catches it. The Joint Chiefs had already caught this one. It had been kicked around at several of the meetings attended by Barbie's old boss, Colonel James Ocox. Sooner or later, someone in the mill was bound to be infected by the same idea. And it wasn't entirely surprising that the someone should turn out to be Rory Dinsmore, who was by far the sharpest tool in the Dinsmore family box.
"I don't know where he gets it from,"
Shelley Dinsmore said, when Rory brought home his first all-A's rank card. And she said it in a voice more worried than proud. If he'd lived in town, and if he'd had a computer, which he did not, Rory would undoubtedly have been a part of Scarecrow Joe McClatchy's posse. Rory had been forbidden to attend the carnival prayer meeting demonstration. Instead of eating weird hot dogs and helping with the car park operation, he was ordered by his father to stay at home and feed the cows. When that was done, he was to grease their udders with bag balm, a job he hated.
"And once you got those teats nice and shiny," his father said, "you could sweep the barns and bust up some hay bales."
He was being punished for approaching the dome yesterday after his father had expressly forbidden it, and actually knocking on it, for God's sake. Appealing to his mother, which often worked, did no good this time.
"You could have been killed," Shelley said. "Also, your dad says you mouthed off."
"Just told him the cook's name," Rory protested. And for that, his father once more had gone upside his head, while Ollie looked on with smug and silent approval.
"You're too smart for your own good," Alden said.
Safely behind his father's back, Ollie had stuck out his tongue. Shelley saw, however, and went upside Ollie's head. She did not, however, forbid him the pleasures and excitements of that afternoon's makeshift fair.
"And you leave that goddamn go-kart alone," Alden said, pointing to the ATV parked in the shade between Dairy Barns 1 and 2. "You need to move hay, you carry it. It'll build you up a little."
Shortly thereafter, the dim Dinsmores went off together, walking across the field toward Romeo's tent. The bright one was left behind with a hay fork and a jar of bag balm as big as a flower pot. Rory went about his chores glumly but thoroughly. His racing mind sometimes got him in trouble. But he was a good son for all that, and the idea of ditching punishment chores never crossed his mind. At first, nothing crossed his mind. He was in that mostly empty-headed stead of grace which is sometimes such fertile soil. It's the ground from which our brightest dreams and biggest ideas, both the good and the spectacularly bad, suddenly burst forth, often full-blown. Yet there is always a chain of association. As Rory began sweeping Barn 1's main aisle, he would save the hateful udder greasing for last, he reckoned. He heard a rapid pop-pow-pam,
that could only be a string of firecrackers. They sounded a little like gunshots. This made him think of his father's rifle, which was propped in the front closet. The boys were forbidden to touch it except under strict supervision, while shooting at targets or in hunting season. But it wasn't locked up, and the ammo was on the shelf above it. And the idea came. Rory thought, I could blow a hole in that thing. Maybe pop it. He had an image bright and clear of touching a match to the side of a balloon. He dropped the broom and ran for the house. Like many bright people, especially bright children, inspiration rather than consideration was his strong suit. If his older brother had had such an idea, unlikely. Ollie would have thought, if a plane couldn't bust through it or a pulp truck going full tilt, what chance does a bullet have? He might also have reasoned, I'm in Dutch already for disobeying, and this is disobedience raised to the ninth power. Well, no, Ollie probably wouldn't have thought that. Ollie's mathematical abilities had topped out at simple multiplication. Rory, however, was already taking college track algebra and knocking it dead. If asked how a bullet could accomplish what a truck or an airplane hadn't, he would have said the impact effect of a Winchester Elite XP3 would be far greater than either. It stood to reason. For one thing, the velocity would be greater. For another, the impact itself would be concentrated upon the point of a 180-grain bullet. He was sure it would work. It had the unquestionable elegance of an algebraic equation. Rory saw his smiling, but of course modest, face on the front page of USA Today, being interviewed on Nightly News with Brian Williams, sitting on a flower-bedecked float in a parade in his honor with prom queen-type girls surrounding him, probably in strapless gowns, but possibly in bathing suits. As he waved to the crowd and confetti floated down in drifts, he would be the boy who saved Chester's Mill. He snatched the rifle from the closet, got the step stool, and pawed a box of XP3s down from the shelf. He stuffed two cartridges into the breech, one for a backup, then raced back outside with the rifle held above his head like a conquering rebelista. But give him this, he engaged the safety without even thinking about it. The key to the Yamaha ATV he had been forbidden to ride was hanging on the pegboard in barn one. He held the key fob between his teeth while he strapped the rifle to the back of the ATV with a couple of bungee cords. He wondered if there would be a sound when the dome popped. He probably should have taken the shooter's plugs from the top shelf of the closet, but going back for them was unthinkable. He had to do this now. That's how it is with big ideas. He drove the ATV around barn two, pausing just long enough to size up the crowd in the field. Excited as he was, he knew better than to head for where the dome crossed the road, and where the smudges of yesterday's collisions still hung like dirt on an unwashed windowpane. Someone might stop him before he could pop the dome. Then, instead of being the boy who saved Chester's Mill, he'd likely wind up as the boy who greased cow tits for a year. Yes, and for the first week he'd be doing it in a crouch, his ass too sore to sit down. Someone else would end up getting the credit for his big idea. So he drove on a diagonal that would bring him to the dome 500 yards or so from the tent, marking the place to stop by the crushed spots in the hay. Those, he knew, had been made by falling birds. He saw the soldiers stationed in that area turn toward the oncoming blat of the ATV. He heard shouts of alarm from the fair and prayer folks. The hymn singing came to a discordant halt. Worst of all, he saw his father waving his dirty John Deere cap at him and bawling, Rory, oh God damn it, you stop! Rory was in too deep to stop, and, good son or not, he didn't want to stop. The ATV struck a hummock, and he bounced clear of the seat, holding on with his hands and laughing like a loon. His own deer cap was spun around backward, and he didn't even remember doing it. The ATV tilted, then decided to stay up. Almost there now. And one of the fatigues-clad soldiers was also shouting at him to stop. Rory did. And so suddenly he almost somersaulted over the Yamaha's handlebars. He forgot to put the darn thing in neutral, and it lurched forward, actually striking the dome, before stalling out. Rory heard the crimp of metal, and the tinkle of the headlight as it shattered. The soldiers, afraid of being hit by the ATV, the eye which sees nothing to block an oncoming object triggers powerful instincts, fell off to either side, leaving a nice big hole and sparing Rory the need of telling them to move away from a possible explosive blowout. He wanted to be a hero, but didn't want to hurt or kill anybody to do it. He had to hurry. The people closest to his stopping point were the ones in the parking lot and clustered around the summer blowout sail tent, and they were running like hell. His father and brother were among them, both screaming at him to not do whatever he was planning to do. Rory yanked the rifle free of the bungee cords, socked the butt plate into his shoulder, and aimed at the invisible barrier 5 feet above a trio of dead sparrows. "No, kid, bad idea," one of the soldiers shouted. Rory paid him no mind because it was a good idea. The people from the tent in the parking lot were close now. Someone, it was Lester Coggins, who ran a lot better than he played guitar, shouted, "In the name of God, son, don't do that!" Rory pulled the trigger. No, only tried to. The safety was still on. He looked over his shoulder and saw the tall, thin preacher from the Holy Roller Church blow past his puffing, red-faced father. Lester's shirt tail was out and flying. His eyes were wide. The cook from Sweetbriar Rose was right behind him. They were no more than 60 yards away now, and the Reverend looked like he was just getting into fourth gear. Rory thumbed off the safety. "No, kid, no!" the soldier cried again, simultaneously crouching on his side of the dome and holding out his splayed hands. Rory paid no attention. It's that way with big ideas. He fired. It was, unfortunately for Rory, a perfect shot. The high-impact slug struck the dome dead on, ricocheted, and came back like a rubber ball on a string. Rory felt no immediate pain, but a vast sheet of white light filled his head as the smaller of the two slug's two fragments thumbed out his left eye and lodged in his brain. Blood flew in a spray, then ran through his fingers as he dropped to his knees, clutching his face. 12.
"I'm blind! I'm blind!"
the boy was screaming, and Lester immediately thought of the scripture upon which his finger had landed. "Madness and blindness and astonishment of the heart."
"I'm blind! I'm blind!"
Lester pried away the boy's hands and saw the red welling socket. The remains of the eye itself were dangling on Rory's cheek. As he turned his head up to Lester, the splattered remains plopped into the grass. Lester had a moment to cradle the child in his arms before the father arrived and tore him away. That was all right. That was as it should be. Lester had sinned and begged guidance from the Lord. Guidance had been given and answer provided. He knew now what he was to do about the sins he'd been led into by James Rennie. A blind child had shown him the way. This is not as bad as it gets. 1. What Rusty Everett would recall later was confusion. The only image that stuck out with complete clarity was Pastor Coggins' naked upper body, fish belly white skin and stacked ribs. Barbie, however, perhaps because he'd been tasked by Colonel Cox to put on his investigator's hat again, saw everything. And his clearest memory wasn't of Coggins with his shirt off. It was of Melvin Searles pointing a finger at him and then tilting his head slightly. Sign language any man recognizes as meaning, "We ain't done yet, sunshine." What everyone else remembered, what brought the town situation home to them as perhaps nothing else could, were the father's cries as he held his wretched, bleeding boy in his arms, and the mother screaming.
"Is he all right, Alden? Is he all right?"
as she labored her 60 pounds overweight bulk toward the scene. Barbie saw Rusty Everett push through the circle gathering around the boy and join the two kneeling men, Alden and Lester. Alden was cradling his son in his arms as Pastor Coggins stared with his mouth sagging like a gate with a busted hinge. Rusty's wife was right behind him. Rusty fell on his knees between Alden and Lester and tried to pull the boy's hands away from his face. Alden, not surprisingly in Barbie's opinion, promptly socked him one. Rusty's nose started to bleed.
"No, let him help,"
the PA's wife yelled. Linda, Barbie thought. Her name is Linda, and she's a cop.
"No, Alden, no."
Linda put her hand on the farmer's shoulder, and he turned, apparently ready to sock her. All sense had departed his face. He was an animal protecting a cub.
Barbie moved forward to catch his fist, if the farmer let it fly, then had a better idea. "Medic here," he shouted, bending into Alden's face and trying to block Linda from his field of vision. "Medic, medic, med—" Barbie was yanked backward by the collar of his shirt and spun around. He had just time enough to register Mel Searles, one of Junior's buddies, and to realize that Searles was wearing a blue uniform shirt and a badge. "This is as bad as it gets," Barbie thought. But as if to prove him wrong, Searles socked him in the face, just as he had that night in Dipper's parking lot. He missed Barbie's nose, which had probably been his target, but mashed Barbie's lips back against his teeth. Searles drew back his fist to do it again, but Jackie Weddington, Mel's unwilling partner that day, grabbed his arm before he could. "Don't do it," she shouted. "Officer, don't do it." For a moment, the issue was in doubt. Then Ollie Dinsmore, closely followed by his sobbing, gasping mother, passed between them, knocking Searles back a step. Searles lowered his fist. "Okay," he said. "But you're in a crime scene, asshole. Police investigation scene. Whatever." Barbie wiped his bleeding mouth with the heel of his hand and thought, "This is not as bad as it gets. That's the hell of it. It's not." 2. The only part of this Rusty heard was Barbie shouting, "Medic." Now he said it himself. "Medic, Mr. Dinsmore, Rusty Everett, you know me. Let me look at your boy."
"Let him, Alden," Shelley cried. "Let him take care of Rory."
Alden relaxed his grip on the kid, who was swaying back and forth on his knees, his blue jeans soaked with blood. Rory had covered his face with his hands again. Rusty took hold of them, gently, gently does it, and pulled them down. He had hoped it wouldn't be as bad as he feared, but the socket was raw and empty, pouring blood, and the brain behind that socket was hurt plenty. The news was in how the remaining eye cocked senselessly skyward, bulging at nothing. Rusty started to pull his shirt off, but the preacher was already holding out his own. Coggan's upper body, thin and white in front, striped with criss-crossing red welts in back, was running with sweat. He held the shirt out. "No," Rusty said. "Rip it, rip it." For a moment, Lester didn't get it. Then he tore the shirt down the middle. The rest of the police contingent was arriving now, and some of the regular cops, Henry Morrison, George Frederick, Jackie Weddington, Freddie Denton, were yelling at the new special deputies to help move the crowd back, make some space. The new hires did so, and enthusiastically. Some of the rubberneckers were knocked down, including that famous Bratz torturer, Samantha Bushy. Sammy had little Walter in a papoose carrier, and when she went on her ass, both of them began to squall. Junior Rennie stepped over her without so much as a look and grabbed Rory's mom, almost pulling the wounded boy's mother off her feet before Freddie Denton stopped him.
"No, Junior, no, it's the kid's mother. Let her loose."
"Police brutality,"
Sammy Bushy yelled from where she lay in the grass.
"Police brutal—"
Georgia Rue, the newest hire in what had become Peter Randolph's police department, arrived with Carter Thibodeau, holding his hand, actually. Georgia pressed her boot against one of Sammy's breasts, it wasn't quite a kick, and said,
"Yo, Dyke, shut up."
Junior let go of Rory's mother and went to stand with Mel, Carter, and Georgia. They were staring at Barbie. Junior added his eyes to theirs, thinking that the cook was like a bad goddamn penny that kept turning up. He thought Barbie would look awfully good in a cell right next to Sloppy Sam's. Junior also thought that being a cop had been his destiny all along. It had certainly helped with his headaches. Rusty took half of Lester's torn shirt and ripped it again. He folded a piece, started to put it over the gaping wound in the boy's face, then changed his mind and gave it to the father. "Hold it to the—" The words barely came out. His throat was full of blood from his mashed nose. Rusty hawked it back, turned his head, spat a half-clotted loogie into the grass, and tried again. "Hold it to the wound, Dad. Apply pressure. Hand to the back of his neck and squeeze." Dazed but willing, Alden Dinsmore did as he was told. The makeshift pad immediately turned red, but the man seemed calmer nonetheless. Having something to do helped. It usually did.
Rusty flung the remaining piece of shirt at Lester. More, he said, and Lester began ripping the shirt into smaller pieces. Rusty lifted Dinsmore's hand and removed the first pad, which was now soaked and useless. Shelley Dinsmore shrieked when she saw the empty socket.
Oh, my boy! My boy!
Peter Randolph arrived at a jog, huffing and puffing. Still, he was far ahead of Big Jim, who, mindful of his substandard ticker, was plodding down the slope of the field on grass the rest of the crowd had trampled into a broad path. He was thinking of what a cluster mug this had turned out to be. Town gatherings would have to be by permit only in the future, and if he had anything to do with it, he would. He always did. Permits would be hard to come by.
Move these people back further,
Randolph snarled at Officer Morrison. And as Henry turned to do so,
move it back, folks! Give them some air!
Morrison bawled, officers form a line, push them back! Anyone who resists, put them in cuffs! The crowd began a slow reverse shuffle. Barbie lingered. Mr. Everett, Rusty, do you need any help? Are you okay? Fine, Rusty said, and his face told Barbie everything he needed to know. The PA was all right, just a bloody nose. The kid wasn't, and never would be again, even if he lived. Rusty applied a fresh pad to the kid's bleeding eye socket and put the father's hand over it again. Nape of the neck, he said, press hard. Hard. Barbie started to step back, but then the kid spoke. 3.
It's Halloween. You can't... We can't...
Rusty froze in the act of folding another piece of shirt into a compression pad. Suddenly he was back in his daughter's bedroom listening to Janelle scream, It's the Great Pumpkin's fault. He looked up at Linda. She had heard too. Her eyes were big, the color fleeing her previously flushed cheeks.
Linda, Rusty snapped at her, get on your walkie, call the hospital, tell Twitch to get the ambulance.
The fire!
Rory Dinsmore screamed in a high, trembling voice. Lester was staring at him as Moses might have stared at the burning bush.
The fire! The bus is in the fire! Everyone's screaming! Watch out for Halloween!
The crowd was silent now, listening to the child rant. Even Jim Rennie heard as he reached the back of the mob and began to elbow his way through.
Linda, Rusty shouted, get on your walkie. We need the ambulance.
She started visibly, as if someone had just clapped his hands in front of her face. She pulled the walkie-talkie off her belt. Rory tumbled forward into the flattened grass and began to seize.
What's happening?
That was the father.
Oh, dear, to Jesus, he's dying.
That was the mother. Rusty turned the trembling, bucking child over, trying not to think of Jenny as he did it, but that, of course, was impossible. And tilting his chin up to create an airway.
Come on, Dad, he told Alden. Don't quit on me now. Squeeze the neck. Compression on the wound. Let's stop the bleeding.
Compression might drive the fragment that had taken the kid's eye deeper in, but Rusty would worry about that later. If that was the kid didn't die right out here on the grass. From nearby, but oh so far. One of the soldiers finally spoke up. Barely out of his teens, he looked terrified and sorry.
We tried to stop him. The boy didn't listen. There wasn't nothing we could do.
Pete Freeman, his Nikon dangling by his knee on its strap, favored this young warrior with a smile of singular bitterness.
I think we know that. If we didn't before, we sure do now.
4. Before Barbie could melt into the crowd, Mel Searles grabbed him by the arm. Take your hand off me, Barbie said mildly. Searles showed his teeth in a version of a grin.
In your dreams, fucko.
Then he raised his voice.
Chief! Hey, Chief!
Peter Randolph turned toward him impatiently, frowning.
This guy interfered with me while I was trying to secure the scene. Can I arrest him?
Randolph opened his mouth, possibly to say, don't waste my time. Then he looked around. Jim Rennie had finally joined the little group watching Everett work on the boy. Rennie gave Barbie the flat stare of a reptile on a rock, then looked back at Randolph and nodded slightly. Mel saw it. His grin widened. Jackie, Officer Weddington, I mean. Can I borrow a pair of your cuffs? Junior and the rest of his crew were also grinning. This was better than watching some bleeding kid, and a lot better than policing a bunch of holy rollers and dumbbells with signs.
Payback's a bitch, Barbie, Junior said.
Jackie looked dubious.
Pete, Chief, I mean, I think the guy was only trying to...
Cuff him up, Randolph said. We'll sort out what he was or wasn't trying to do later. In the meantime, I want this mess shut down.
He raised his voice.
It's over, folks. You've had your fun, and see what it's come to. Now go home.
Jackie was removing a set of plastic cuffs from her belt. She had no intention of handing them to Mel Searles, would put them on herself. When Julia Shumway spoke up, she was standing just behind Randolph and Big Jim. In fact, Big Jim had elbowed her aside on his way to where the action was.
I wouldn't do that, Chief Randolph, unless you want the PD embarrassed on the front page of the Democrat.
She was smiling her Mona Lisa smile.
With you so new to the job and all.
What are you talking about? Randolph asked.
His frown was deeper now, turning his face into a series of unlovely crevices. Julia held up her camera, a slightly older version of Pete Freeman's.
I have quite a few pictures of Mr. Barbara assisting Rusty Everett with that wounded child, a couple of Officer Searles hauling Mr. Barbara off for no discernible reason, and one of Officer Searles punching Mr. Barbara in the mouth, also for no discernible reason. I'm not much of a photographer, but that one is really quite good. Would you like to see it, Chief Randolph? You can. The camera's digital.
Barbie's admiration for her deepened because he thought she was running a bluff. If she'd been taking pictures, why was she holding the lens cap in her left hand, as if she'd just taken it off?
It's a lie, Chief, Mel said. He tried to take a swing at me. Ask Junior.
I think my pictures will show that young Mr. Rennie was involved in crowd control and had his back turned when the punch landed, Julia said.
Randolph was glowering at her.
I could take your camera away, he said. Evidence.
You certainly could, she agreed cheerily, and Pete Freeman would take a picture of you doing it.
Then you could take Pete's camera,
but everyone here would see you do it.
Whose side are you on here, Julia? Big Jim asked.
He was smiling his fierce smile, the smile of a shark about to take a bite out of some plump swimmer's ass. Julia turned her own smile on him, the eyes above it as innocent and inquiring as a child's.
Are there sides, James? Other than over there? She pointed at the watching soldiers. And in here?
Big Jim considered her, his lips now bending the other way, a smile in reverse. Then he flapped one disgusted hand at Randolph.
I guess we'll let it slide, Mr. Barbara, Randolph said. Heat of the moment.
Thanks, Barbie said. Jackie took her glowering young partner's arm.
Come on, Officer Searles. This part's over. Let's move these people back.
Searles went with her, but not before turning to Barbie and making the gesture. Finger pointing, head cocked slightly.
We ain't done yet, sunshine.
Romy's assistant, Toby Manning, and Jack Evans appeared, carrying a makeshift stretcher made out of canvas and tent poles. Romy opened his mouth to ask what the hell they thought they were doing, then closed it again. The field day had been canceled anyway. So, what the hell?
5. Those with cars got into them. Then they all tried to drive away at the same time.
Predictable, Joe McClatchy thought. Totally predictable.
Most of the cops worked to unclog the resulting traffic jam, although even a bunch of kids, Joe was standing with Benny Drake and Nori Calvert, could tell that the new and improved 5-0 had no idea what it was doing.
The sound of po-po curses came clear on the summery air.
Can't you back that son of a whore up?
In spite of the mess, nobody seemed to be laying on their horns. Most folks were probably too bummed to beep.
Benny said, look at those idiots. How many gallons of gas do you think they're blowing out their tailpipes? Like, they think the supply's endless.
Word,
Nori said.
She is a tough kid, a small-town riot girl with a modified Tennessee top-hat mullet do. But now she only looked pale and sad and scared.
She took Benny's hand. Scarecrow Joe's heart broke, then remended itself in an instant when she took his as well.
There goes the guy who almost got arrested, Benny said, pointing with his free hand. Barbie and the newspaper lady were trudging across the field toward the makeshift parking lot with 60 or 80 other people, some dragging their protest signs dispiritedly behind them.
Nancy Newspaper wasn't taking pictures at all, you know,
Scarecrow Joe said. I was standing right behind her.
Pretty foxy.
Yeah, Benny said, but I still wouldn't want to be him till this shit ends. The cops can do pretty much what they want.
That was true, Joe reflected.
And the new cops weren't particularly nice guys. Junior Rennie, for example. The story of Sloppy Sam's arrest was already making the rounds.
What are you saying?
Nori asked Benny.
Nothing right now. It's still cool right now, he considered. Fairly cool. But if this goes on... Remember Lord of the Flies?
They had read it for Honors English. Benny intoned, kill the pig, cut her throat, bash her in.
People call cops pigs, but I'll tell you what I think. I think cops find pigs when the shit gets deep. Maybe because they get scared too.
Nori Calvert burst into tears. Scarecrow Joe put an arm around her. He did it carefully, as if he thought doing such a thing might cause them both to explode. But she turned her face against his shirt and hugged him. It was a one-armed hug, because she was still holding on to Benny with her other hand. Joe thought he had felt nothing in his whole life as weirdly thrilling as her tears dampening his shirt. Over the top of her head, he looked at Benny reproachfully.
Sorry, dude, Benny said, and patted her back. No fear.
His eye was gone, she cried.
The words were muffled against Joe's chest. Then she let go of him.
This isn't fun anymore. This is not fun.
No.
Joe spoke as if discovering a great truth.
It isn't. Look,
Benny said. It was the ambulance. Twitch was bumping across Dinsmore's field with the red roof lights flashing. His sister, the woman who owned Sweetbriar Rose, was walking ahead of him, guiding him around the worst potholes. An ambulance in a hayfield, under a bright afternoon sky in October. It was the final touch. Suddenly, Scarecrow Joe no longer wanted to protest. Nor did he exactly want to go home. At that moment, the only thing in the world he wanted was to get out of town. 6. Julia slid behind the wheel of her car but didn't start it. They were going to be here a while, and there was no sense in wasting gas. She leaned past Barbie, opened the glove compartment, and brought out an old pack of American Spirits.
Emergency supplies, she told him apologetically. Do you want one?
He shook his head.
Do you mind, because I can wait?
He shook his head again. She lit up, then blew smoke out her open window. It was still warm, a real Indian summer day for sure, but it wouldn't stay that way. Another week or so and the weather would turn wrong, as the old-timer said.
Or maybe not, she thought. Who in the hell knows? If the dome stayed in place, she had no doubt that plenty of meteorologists would weigh in on the subject of the weather inside, but so what?
The Weather Channel Yodas couldn't even predict which way a snowstorm would turn. And in Julia's opinion, they deserved no more credence than the political geniuses who blabbed their days away at the Sweetbriar Rose bullshit table.
Thanks for speaking up back there, he said. You saved my bacon. Here's a newsflash, honey. Your bacon's still hanging in the smokehouse. What are you going to do next time? Have your friend Cox call the ACLU? They might be interested, but I don't think anyone from the Portland office is going to be visiting Chester's Mill soon.
Don't be so pessimistic. The dome might blow out to sea tonight. Or just dissipate. We don't know.
Fat chance. This is a government job, some governments, and I'll bet your Colonel Cox knows it.
Barbie was silent. He had believed Cox when Cox said the U.S. hadn't been responsible for the dome. Not because Cox was necessarily trustworthy, but because Barbie just didn't think America had the technology. Or any other country, for that matter. But what did he know? His last service job had been threatening scared Iraqis. Sometimes with a gun to their heads. Junior's friend Frankie De Lesseps was out on Route 119 helping to direct traffic. He was wearing a blue uniform shirt over jeans. There probably hadn't been any uniform pants in his size at the station. He was a tall son of a bitch. And, Julia saw with misgivings, he was wearing a gun on his hip. Smaller than the Glocks the regular mill police carried,
probably his own property. But it was a gun, all right.
What will you do if the Hitler Youth comes after you? She asked, lifting her chin in Frankie's direction. Good luck hollering police brutality if they jug you and decide to finish what they started. There's only two lawyers in town, one senile and the other drives a Boxster Jim Rennie got him at discount. Or so I've heard.
I can take care of myself.
Ooh, macho.
What's up with your paper? It looked ready when I left last night.
Technically speaking, you left this morning, and yes, it's ready. Pete and I and a few friends will make sure it gets distributed. I just didn't see any point in starting while the town was three-quarters empty. Want to be a volunteer newsboy?
I would, but I've got a zillion sandwiches to make. Strictly cold food at the restaurant tonight.
Maybe I'll drop by. She tossed her cigarette, only half-smoked, from the window.
Then, after a moment's consideration, she got out and stepped on it. Starting a grass fire out here would not be cool. Not with the town's new fire truck stranded in Castle Rock.
I swung by Chief Perkins' house earlier, she said as she got back behind the wheel. Except, of course, it's just Brenda's now.
How is she?
Terrible. But when I said you wanted to see her and that it was important, although I didn't say what it was about, she agreed. After dark might be best. I suppose your friend will be impatient.
Stop calling Cox my friend. He is not my friend.
They watched silently as the wounded boy was loaded into the back of the ambulance. The soldiers were still watching, too. Probably against orders. And that made Julia feel a little better about them.
The ambulance began to buck its way back across the field, lights flashing.
This is terrible, she said, in a thin voice.
Barbie put an arm around her shoulders. She tensed for a moment, then relaxed. Looking straight ahead, at the ambulance, which was now turning into a cleared lane in the middle of Route 119, she said,
What if they shut me down, my friend? What if Rennie and his pet police decide to shut my little newspaper down?
That's not going to happen, Barbie said. But he wondered. If this went on long enough, he supposed every day in Chester's Mill would become Anything Can Happen Day.
She had something else in her mind, Julia Shumway said.
Mrs. Perkins?
Yes, it was in many ways a very strange conversation.
She's grieving for her husband, Barbie said. Grief makes people strange. I said hello to Jack Evans. His wife died yesterday when the dome came down, and he looked at me as if he didn't know me, although I've been serving him my famous Wednesday meatloaf since last spring.
I've known Brenda Perkins since she was Brenda Morse, Julia said. Almost 40 years. I thought she might tell me what was troubling her, but she didn't.
Barbie pointed at the road.
I think you can go now.
As Julia started the engine, her cell phone trilled. She almost dropped her bag in her hurry to dig it out. She listened, then handed it to Barbie with her ironic smile.
It's for you, boss.
It was Cox, and Cox had something to say, quite a lot, actually. Barbie interrupted long enough to tell Cox what had happened to the boy, now headed to Kathy Russell. But Cox either didn't relate Rory Dinsmore's story to what he was saying, or didn't want to. He listened politely enough, then went on. When he finished, he asked Barbie a question that would have been in order had Barbie still been in uniform and under his command.
Sir, I understand what you're asking, but you don't understand that...
I guess you'd call it the political situation here, and my little part in it. I had some trouble before this dome thing, and...
We all know about that, Cox said. An altercation with the second selectman's son and some of his friends. You were almost arrested, according to what I've got in my folder.
A folder? Now he's got a folder. God help me.
That's fine intel as far as it goes, Barbie said, but let me give you a little more. One, the police chief who kept me from being arrested... died out on 119, not far from where I'm talking to you, in fact. Faintly, in a world he could not now visit, Barbie heard paper rattle. He suddenly felt he would like to kill Colonel James O. Cox with his bare hands, simply because Colonel James O. Cox could go out for Mickey D's any time he wanted, and he, Dale Barbara, could not.
We know about that, too, Cox said. A pacemaker problem.
Two, Barbie went on, the new chief, who is asshole buddies with the only powerful member of this town's board of selectmen, has hired some new deputies. They're the guys who tried to beat my head off my shoulders in the parking lot of the local nightclub.
Oh, you'll have to rise above that, won't you, Colonel?
Why are you calling me Colonel? You're the Colonel.
Congratulations, Cox said. Not only have you re-enlisted in your country's service, you've gotten an absolutely dizzying promotion.
No, Barbie shouted. Julia was looking at him with concern, but he was hardly aware of it.
No, I don't want it.
Yeah, but you've got it, Cox said calmly. I'm going to email a copy of the essential paperwork to your editor, friend, before we shut down your unfortunate little town's internet capacity.
Shut it down? You can't shut it down.
The paperwork is signed by the president himself. You gonna say no to him? I understand he can be a tad grumpy when he's crossed. Barbie didn't reply. His mind was whirling.
You need to visit the selectmen and the police chief, Cox said. You need to tell them the president has invoked martial law in Chester's Mill, and you're the officer in charge. I'm sure you'll encounter some initial resistance, but the information I've just given you should help establish you as the town's conduit to the outside world. And I know your powers of persuasion. Saw them firsthand in Iraq.
Sir, he said, you have so misread the situation here. He ran a hand through his hair. His ear was throbbing from the goddamn cell phone.
It's as if you can comprehend the idea of the dome, but not what's happening in this town as a result of it. And it's been less than 30 hours.
Help me understand, then.
You say the president wants me to do this. Suppose I were to call him up and tell him he can kiss my rosy red ass.
Julia was looking at him horrified, and this actually inspired him.
Suppose, in fact, I said I was a sleeper Al-Qaeda agent, and I was planning to kill him. Pow, one to the head. How about that?
Lieutenant Barbara, Colonel Barbara, I mean, you've said enough.
Barbie did not feel this was so.
Could he send the FBI to come and grab me? The Secret Service? The goddamn Red Army?
No, sir, he could not.
We have plans to change that, as I have just explained.
Cox no longer sounded loose and good-humored, just one old grunt talking to another.
And if it works, feel free to have the federal agency of your choice come and arrest me, but if we stay cut off, who in here's going to listen to me? Get it through your head. This town has seceded. Not just from America, but from the whole world. There's nothing we can do about it, and nothing you can do about it either.
Quietly, Cox said,
we're trying to help you guys.
You say that, and I almost believe you. Will anybody else around here? When they look to see what kind of help their taxes are buying them, they see soldiers standing guard with their backs turned. That sends a hell of a message.
You're talking a whole lot for someone who's saying no.
I'm not saying no, but I'm only about 9 feet from being arrested, and proclaiming myself the Commandant Pro Tem won't help.
Suppose I were to call the first selectman, what's his name, Sanders, and tell him.
That's what I mean by how little you know. It's like Iraq all over again, only this time you're in Washington instead of boots on the ground, and you seem as clueless as the rest of the desk soldiers. Read my lips, sir. Some intelligence is worse than no intelligence at all.
A little learning is a dangerous thing, Julia said dreamily.
If not Sanders, then who?
James Rennie, the second selectman. He's the boss hog around here.
There was a pause.
Then Cox said,
maybe we can give you the internet. Some of us are of the opinion that cutting it off's just a knee-jerk reaction anyway.
Why would you think that? Barbie asked. Don't you guys know that if you let us stay on the net, Aunt Sarah's cranberry bread recipe is sure to get out sooner or later?
Julia sat up straight and mouthed, they're trying to cut the internet?
Barbie raised one finger toward her.
Wait.
Just hear me out, Barbie. Suppose we call this Rennie and tell him the internet's got to go. So sorry, crisis situation, extreme measures, etc., etc. Then you can convince him of your usefulness by changing our minds.
Barbie considered. It might work, for a while, anyway. Or it might not.
Plus, Cox said brightly, you'll be giving them this other information. Maybe saving some lives. But saving people the scare of their lives, for sure.
Barbie said, phone stay up as well as internet.
That's hard. I might be able to keep the net for you, but listen, man, there are at least 5 Curtis LeMay types sitting on the committee presiding over this mess. And as far as they're concerned, everyone in Chester's Mill is a terrorist until proved otherwise.
What can these hypothetical terrorists do to harm America? Suicide bomb the Congo church?
Barbie, you're preaching to the choir.
Of course, that was probably the truth.
Will you do it?
I'll have to get back to you on that. Wait for my call before you do anything. I have to talk to the late police chief's widow first.
Cox persisted.
Will you keep the horse trading part of this conversation to yourself?
Again, Barbie was struck by how little even Cox, a free thinker by military standards, understood about the changes the dome had already wrought. In here, the Cox brand of secrecy no longer mattered. Us against them, Barbie thought. Now it's us against them. Unless their crazy idea works, that is.
Sir, I really will have to get back to you on that. This phone is suffering a bad case of low battery. A lie, he told with no remorse. And you need to wait to hear from me before you talk to anybody else. Just remember, the Big Bang's scheduled for 1300 tomorrow. If you want to maintain viability on this, you better stay out front.
Maintain viability, another meaningless phrase under the dome. Unless it applied to keeping your Jenny supplied with propane.
We'll talk, Barbie said. He closed the phone before Cox could say more. 119 was almost clear now, although de Lesseps was still there, leaning against his vintage muscle car with his arms folded. As Julia drove past the Nova, Barbie noted a sticker reading, Ass, Gas, or Grass. Nobody rides for free. Also a police bubblegum light on the dash. He thought the contrast summed up everything that was now wrong in Chester's Mill. As they rode, Barbie told her everything Cox had said.
What they're planning is really no different than what that kid just tried, she said, sounding appalled.
Well, a little different, Barbie said. The kid tried it with a rifle. They've got a cruise missile lined up. Call it the Big Bang Theory.
She smiled. It wasn't her usual one. Wan and bewildered. It made her look 60 instead of 43. I think I'm going to be putting out another paper sooner than I thought.
Barbie nodded. Extra, extra, read all about it. 7.
Hello, Sammy, someone said. How are you?
Samantha Bushy didn't recognize the voice and turned toward it warily, hitching up the papoose carrier as she did. Little Walter was asleep and he weighed a ton. Her butt hurt from falling on it. And her feelings were hurt, too, that damn Georgia Rue calling her a dyke. Georgia Rue, who had come whining around Sammy's trailer more than once, looking to score an 8-ball for her and the muscle-bound freak she went around with. It was Dodie's father. Sammy had spoken with him thousands of times, but she hadn't recognized his voice. She hardly recognized him. He looked old and sad, broken somehow. He didn't even scope out her boobs, which was a first.
Hi, Mr. Sanders. Gee, I didn't even see you at the...
She flapped her hand back toward the flattened-down field in the big tent, now half-collapsed and looking forlorn, although not as forlorn as Mr. Sanders.
I was sitting in the shade.
That same hesitant voice, coming through an apologetic hurting smile that was hard to look at.
I had something to drink, though. Wasn't it warm for October? Golly, yes. I thought it was a good afternoon, a real town afternoon, until that boy...
Oh, Crispy Crackers, he was crying.
I'm awful sorry about your wife, Mr. Sanders.
Thank you, Sammy, that's very kind. Can I carry your baby back to your car for you? I think you can go now. The road's almost clear.
That was an offer Sammy couldn't refuse, even if he was crying. She scooped little Walter out of the papoose. It was like picking up a big clump of warm bread dough and handed him over. Little Walter opened his eyes, smiled glassily, belched, then went back to sleep.
I think he might have a package in his diaper, Mr. Sanders said.
Yeah, he's a regular shit machine. Good old little Walter.
Walter's a very nice old-fashioned name.
Thanks.
Telling him that her baby's first name was actually Little didn't seem worth the trouble. And she was sure she'd had that conversation with him before anyway, he just didn't remember. Walking with him like this, even though he was carrying the baby, was the perfect bummer end to a perfect bummer afternoon. At least he was right about the traffic. The automotive mosh pit had finally cleared out. Sammy wondered how long it would be before the whole town was riding bicycles again.
I never liked the idea of her in that plane, Mr. Sanders said.
He seemed to be picking up the thread of some interior conversation.
Sometimes I even wondered if Claudie was sleeping with that guy.
Dodie's mom sleeping with Chuck Thompson? Sammy was both shocked and intrigued.
Probably not, he said, and sighed. In any case, it doesn't matter now. Have you seen Dodie? She didn't come home last night.
Sammy almost said sure yesterday afternoon. But if the Dodster hadn't slept at home last night, saying that would only worry the Dodster's dadster.